Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Today, you're going to meet Associate Professor Justin Cohen from the Ehrenberg Bass Institute in South Australia. This is where some of the world's best marketing minds are headquartered. Their research in the past two decades has completely transformed the study of marketing, turning it from guesswork into something approaching a science. Justin's own expertise is in food and wine marketing, among other things, and he has both international experience in research and real-world applications. So in this episode, we're going to cover off some of the big ideas. The first of these is mental availability. Now, this isn't awareness, but it's whether your brand springs to mind at the moment of need. So, for example, when someone thinks, I need lunch, and their favourite sandwich shop pops straight into their mind. We'll also talk about the law of double jeopardy, which says that small brands suffer twice because not only do they have fewer buyers, but those buyers buy less often. Now, this law leads to a counterintuitive finding that chasing loyalty can be a waste of time. And we'll also touch on what Justin calls the law of duplication of purpose, which is that people buy from a repertoire. So say you make a Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc brand. No matter how popular you are, your customers are probably buying other brands of Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc as well. In other words, your customers are also someone else's customers, and we're going to dive into the implications of that. If you make or market drinks, this is your roadmap to what works, what's wishful thinking, and how to win more often. Now, it's quite a dense interview, so the takeaways will be in the Drinks Insider newsletter before the end of the year. So make sure you're the first to know by signing up at drinksinsider.com. Justin, thank you so much for joining me. Can you start by telling me what the Ehrenberg Bass Institute is and what it does?
Sure. Thank you, Felicity. I appreciate you inviting me to participate in your podcast. So the Ehrenberg Bass Institute for Marketing Science is based at the University of South Australia, soon to be Adelaide University. We are the world's largest center for research into marketing. So just a delineation, although we do market research for our sponsors all around the world, our primary focus is into fundamental research into how marketing works. So we work at understanding what law-like patterns exist in marketing and really the fundamentals of how brands grow. So where today we're talking about wine or maybe a bit more broadly in the spirit sector, what fundamentally makes the Ehrenberg Bass Institute unique is that we're interested in looking at patterns in everything from wine to pharmaceuticals to consumer packaged goods to services to durables, emerging markets, established markets. So we're looking to kind of understand the laws of how brands grow.
Okay, so you are the man I definitely want to talk to. Before I ask you about your research, I just want to know, from what you said, does wine behave differently to other categories? Is it a completely unique product, or all the laws of marketing apply to everybody?
No, it's wine is not a unique product. It's something that we're all passionate about. And this is something that I discovered when I started working on wine all the way at the beginning of my research career. People assumed wine is different because it has so many different stock keeping units or bottles of wine, but you can also look at confectionery or cosmetics and you can see the same things as well. So I wouldn't say that wine behaves differently, and a lot of the challenges in the wine sector are quite similar to other categories as well. It's just that most of the brands in the wine sector, excluding the few big ones, are very, very small brands, which means that they have some challenges to overcome, but that's why understanding the principles of marketing are even more important.
Oh, great. All right. This is going to be a great conversation. So can you start by telling me what's your research focus and what's your current research focus?
Sure. So, I mean, my main work at the Ehrenberg Bass Institute is conducting research into advertising and retailing. My particular interests are in studying new formats of advertising and retailing, whether that's a new type of media or a new advertising format or a new channel like direct-to-consumer. In the Institute, we call advertising and retailing a bit more, we call them mental and physical availability. So we're looking at understanding how a brand gets thought of and how it gets found and buy. I work with our sponsors all around the world, helping them implement that into their businesses. So we have a big executive development component of the Ehrenberg Bass Institute, where we run both private, so four individual companies, where we bring 35 people together and we run through a customized workshop and training on embedding the laws using their own data. And then we also have a public format called How Brands Grow Live for Executives, which is a really fun four-day program that
Yeah,
so we do that in Singapore, in Bordeaux, and in Boston.
Do you track the results of that? Like, do people come along and you, like, give them a brand makeover, and then 6 months later you can see that things have changed?
Yeah, so the idea of the program is we give them the brand makeover. We teach them how to do their own brand makeover. They develop an action plan, and then we have follow-up calls with them where we check in on their progress as they go. So where it's not just teaching, it's actually we help them embed the principles into their own job. In the company version, depending on our relationship with them, we have ongoing research that we provide that help them track their measurement of mental availability and their distinctive
assets.
Without
giving any names away, have you seen any like spectacular examples of people turning their brands around as a result of understanding how marketing works better?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see this all the time, and there are some publicly available case studies of some companies that have done it really well. I think that there's so much on the internet today and so many people talking about marketing and growth and the Institute's principles. I think there's two aspects of it. One, do you follow the science? But then the other part of it is how well you go about making sure that it's not just the CMO or the CEO that follow the principles, but that when you have a business that has thousands and thousands of marketeers, that you can create a system where you can actually train and embed that knowledge. And what we actually see is people rising within their own organizations that follow the principles and even moving on to other organizations where they take that experience with them.
Okay, so let's get stuck into what the principles are. First of all, you mentioned mental availability. Can you define the difference between mental availability and awareness?
Sure, that's a great question. Awareness is very much kind of a binary thing, like you know a brand or you don't. I know Coca-Cola or I don't. I know Penfolds or I don't. Mental availability is a much more nuanced and deeper understanding, and it understands the memory structures linking your brand and your competitive set or your category and your competing categories to the category entry point. So we're trying to understand what are the occasions or reasons why someone enters the category. So often it may not be useful to understand whether or not somebody knows your wine brand name or not. What's more useful is that when somebody is thinking about for gift giving or for a romantic occasion or when they're looking for a relaxing drink at home, whether or not your brand enters into their consideration set. And what we see in research, not just in wine, but across all categories, people have different kind of consideration sets of brands for different purchase occasions. So mental availability is about trying to understand what brings people into the category and then how we can develop strategies to link our brand to those key occasions or reasons why somebody shifts from being a normal person to now a person that wants to buy alcohol or a person that wants to buy wine.
Okay, so how does that work when people have, I'm not sure if I'm going to ask this correctly, but bear with me. I'm just thinking when you have a category that is more powerful than the brand, like you have a category like champagne or a category, how do you break out of the category? How do you get mental availability when you're overwhelmed by the set that you sit in?
So, well, first of all, I think it depends on where you want to operate in. Obviously, the research is budget contingent. It's you can't necessarily do research in sparkling wine and champagne and white wine and red wine. I would advocate probably starting broad first within the wine category, because often your competition is going to come not just competing with other champagne, but competing with other wine styles. So when you think about champagne, the primary thing you think about is people are celebrating. That's a key buying occasion, but people could have a glass of champagne in an airport lounge. They could have it at brunch. Mm. They could have it with friends. So the key thing, if you're trying to grow your brand, or even you're a big brand in the champagne category and you're already big, but you want to grow that, it's trying to stretch more broadly to also be thought of in other consumption and usage occasions, whether that's for other wine styles, or it could even be other alcohol categories. Like, you know, why are people buying scotch? Why are people buying pre-mixed drinks? I'm not necessarily saying there's an overlap between champagne and pre-mixed drinks, but there are other premium alcohol categories.
Yeah. Does mental availability behave differently if the product is not something that you buy all the time, but it's something that you experience? Like it is like champagne at a wedding or champagne at a celebration. Do these laws apply differently depending on context, or are they fixed?
I mean, mental availability is all about context. So depending on your category, it's understanding the occasions or reasons why somebody enters the category. We do this research with consumer packaged goods, but we also do it for categories that have really long interpurchase intervals, or even in like a business-to-business context where there's lots of time that goes between buying and contracting services. I would argue that when you're a infrequently purchased category, building mental availability is almost more important, because there's some element of building mental availability through frequent usage of a category, where if you're thinking about something that people don't buy all that often, it's very easy for people to forget that actually champagne is something that's useful for a need. So if you're thinking about gift giving, you might think about giving somebody flowers or a box of chocolates. You've previously maybe bought champagne as a gift, but if you haven't been reminded and refreshed those memory structures that champagne is suitable for gift giving, it's not going to give you the opportunity to get into that race to be considered.
Okay. So then the next obvious question is, how do you get into that mental space, especially if you're a small producer and you don't have many resources? Let's take it another way. Just say you're a big person and you do have resources. How do you go about taking up mental availability?
Sure. So first of all, even the biggest brands in the world that have budgets probably bigger than entire wine industries for advertising still complain that they don't have enough money for advertising.
and the wine industry's going, I can hear the world's smallest violin.
Yeah, so I mean, no one ever has enough money. The key thing is that there is a whole suite of what we call these category entry points that you can invest in. Smart marketers know how to prioritize all those category entry points and invest in the ones that matter. So we have a framework where we look at what we call the three C's, so our commonality, credibility, and competition. So first of all, you want to get a behavioral measure. You want to prioritize investing in category entry points that are common buying occasions for your market. So you want to understand, of all of the occasions or reasons why somebody buys wine, what is kind of the penetration in the last 30 days or the last 3 months of buying wine for that reason? Then you want to think about your specific brand, how credible you are against that category entry point. So if you know that, you know, people do buy wine a lot for a relaxing drink at home, how likely is it that your brand is actually associated with that occasion? So you measure some kind of memory cues of how that links to that. And then you also want to think about the overall level of competition. So all things being equal, even if you have some credibility on that category entry point, or you don't at least have a deficit, if there's lots of other brands that also have strengths on that, then you may decide that there are other category entry points that you want to invest in. So a brand should probably have a short list of category entry points, so like 4 to 6 category entry points that they message against, because they do have limited budgets and they don't want to confuse people by putting too much into a single advertising campaign or message.
So I'm actually thinking about, there's a trend going on in North America at the moment where people are just calling their wines after the occasion. They're calling it pizza night, or they're calling it, whatever it is. Is that a good idea, or is that too blunt an instrument?
So I think that comes down to, that's kind of the creative execution. It may be too literal. And often we find when you get too specific, like for pizza night, it may be easier to think about like pairing with food or when you're gathering with friends. So what is that pizza night? Is it purely just eating pizza, or is it some sort of emotional experience where you're with loved ones or you're with friends or you're relaxing? So I think that there's opportunity to kind of take it a step further and link it back to what are the underlying reasons why people are consuming wine. And then kind of the creative execution is, if lots of people in the US are having wine and pizza, then you can show people spending time together having a pizza night with wine. But it's really kind of trying to think about what are the underlying reasons why people, you know, are entering the category for wine or alcohol more broadly.
All right. Difference between distinctiveness and differentiation.
Ooh, good question. So what we advocate, and the differentiation part kind of links back to mental availability as well, is that if you try and differentiate because you believe in segmentation, targeting, and positioning, the challenge there is, if you're only known for one thing, you only come to mind in when people enter the category for that buying occasion, which can be quite limiting. So what we would advocate is having good messaging that links to key category entry points. And what we know is that bigger brands are bought more often because they're thought of in more buying occasions. So I would rather think about kind of differentiation versus mental availability. The distinctive assets part about it is, those are the anchors that you want to use to connect your brand with those memory structures that you're trying to build, so that when somebody comes into a buying scenario, and whether they're in a retailer or they're in a restaurant and they're navigating a wine list, or they're in a bar and they're looking at bottles of wine on a shelf, that they have a chance of recognizing, hey, that's the wine I've had before, or that's the wine that I've read about or seen some sort of communication about. And you have this, you know, link in your head that helps you identify it. And those distinctive assets are the non-brand name elements, in addition to the brand name, that help signal that's that brand that I know or that I recognize. So that can be
Penfold's Red.
Yeah, it could be red, or it could potentially be the font style. It could be the shape, you know, the angle on which the Penfolds is written. I mean, I would never say things are distinctive assets without doing measurement on them. But the idea of doing distinctive assets is, you want to deconstruct all of these potential things that people can use. It could be a tagline. It could be a jingle. It could be the shape of the bottle.
What isn't distinctive then? If all of these things can be elements of distinctiveness, what ensures your brand will not be distinctive?
Well, what ensures you won't be distinctive is that if you don't protect your brand and you don't conserve your brand and you're constantly changing things. So you go and you look at, if you go into a retailer and you look at wine labels from the same brand, every wine label often will look different.
Right.
Year to year, they will change in style. What we're looking for is consistency, so that whether you're looking at the red wine or the white wine, or you're looking at Cabernet Sauvignon or Shiraz or a blend, that largely they're all looking very, very similar and the labels are easy to identify. But if you have every single year, you have a new brand manager or a, you know, the winemakers wanting to change things or signal things that is interesting to them, that becomes really harder for people to actually notice that. So the way that you have a distinctive asset is by co-presentation of the asset with the brand name and doing it consistently over long periods of time. And over time, you would then get measurement of that and you would see that there's two metrics that we look at, fame and uniqueness. And you would want to see that everybody can identify that asset and that it links to your brand and that it's not getting misattributed to competitors.
Okay, I've got two questions to ask you. So first of all, should you, if you've got different tiers within your brand portfolio, should you make them look different? Like if you've got if you're a Napa winery with a $500 Cabernet, but you're also producing something like Barefoot, should those two things look like each other or should you be very careful to keep them separate? And then can you tell me what the difference between fame and uniqueness is?
Sure. So to your first question, I think that there's a difference between if you have different brands, right? So the example that you gave, but if you think about like Penfolds, that has everything from Grange all the way down to like Canunga Hill. If you're under the same brand name, we have a colleague in the Institute named Dr. Ella Ward who studies portfolio cohesion. And what we say is it's better to look more like your other products than it is to look like the category. So the idea here is that you want to signal that's the strength of the brand is that people can actually identify the brand. Certainly there are things that you can do to make certain things more premium and less premium. It's a very expensive bottle. Maybe it comes in a gift box. There's other things that you can do, but that's also an opportunity that if you have a gift box or other forms of packaging, that also can be really well branded and try and hero what your distinctive assets are.
Okay, now tell me about the difference between fame and uniqueness.
Sure. So when we measure distinctive assets, we are trying to, and we have a special grid that we look at, which classifies things into whether it's an asset that you want to use or monitor for later or be careful using because it cues other brands. So we have a grid that we use in distinctive assets. But what we're measuring is if I show you the Penfolds label or just the Penfolds logo, the words Penfolds, but I mix up the letters so it doesn't say Penfolds, it says something different, but it's in the red and it's in that font and in that angled way, I want to know how many people can see that and go that are category buyers of wine in the chosen market you're doing that. So if that's Australia or you're doing it for Gallo in the United States and you're looking at the logo for Gallo, a piece of the logo, what proportion of the people can identify that logo unprompted is Gallo or Penfolds or Lafite or, Ruinart. Then the uniqueness is what proportion of people that attributed a name to that, what proportion of that is actually the focal brand versus their queuing other brands instead, because you're showing people the assets disguised. So, and what that helps you understand is not only the strength of the asset of like how many people know it, but also is there competition? And specifically when they're queuing other brands, is it a competitor that you should be worried about, because the last thing that you want to do is use something on your packaging or on a shelf or in an advertisement that somebody who's not paying full attention to it will look at and actually think they're seeing something for one of your competitors.
All right, moving right along. Can you explain the law of double jeopardy? And
yep.
What drinks brands with very limited resources should do to plan growth when things like both penetration and loyalty is stacked against them?
Yep. Well, I think that that is the same. I mean, the law of double jeopardy tells us that small brands suffer twice because they have fewer buyers, so lower penetration, and the people that buy them slightly less often. So that's measured by purchase frequency, or more broadly, the term that you used, loyalty. So we know that bigger brands are bigger because they have far many more buyers of them who buy them slightly more often. So the first thing is, as a brand, particularly a small brand, growth will never be achieved through focusing on loyalty. Okay, because even if you improve the loyalty, the difference between the loyalty of the big and the smallest brands don't differ nearly as much as the difference between the biggest and the smallest brands in the category. So the way to grow a brand is to increase the number of buyers that you have. And we see that, which is different to double jeopardy, but we also look at the negative binomial distribution, which shows us that, again, we see the similar pattern of this reverse J-shaped curve, and the big difference is in the non-buyers, so the number of people who aren't buying the brand, and our goal is to reduce that number of non-buyers. So if you're a really, really small brand, then you have to be even better and more focused on your marketing than the biggest brands. No brand wants to lose any money, but a big brand can probably afford to make mistakes where a small brand can't, because maybe they can only do one campaign or one initiative a year, where a bigger brand might be doing something every quarter or every month.
How does this apply to small production that everybody wants, you know, like a Wendouree or a wine from the Jura or something? Where does the law of double jeopardy apply to that? You know, you might only buy it once, but it's in your head a lot.
Well, first of all, I would say I don't think it's in your head a lot. The goal is, and that even for those specialist Wendouree's or Jura or whatever, there's still a competitive set. So you need to refresh those memory structures and remind people that you exist and connect them with key buying occasions. I guess what we're talking about is people hear about the Institute and we talk about mass marketing and mass reach. We don't mean reaching every single person. It's reaching as many of your potential category buyers as possible. So if you're selling Wendouree or some other specialist, very expensive wine, the idea here would be how you can appeal to the group of people who would be potential category buyers for an ultra premium wine. That being said, early work that I did many, many years ago at the start of my academic career was looking at the laws of growth for wine attributes. And one of the attributes that we explored is price. And we found that people who buy very expensive wine also buy inexpensive wine and vice versa. But you would be thinking about from the perspective of, if I'm trying to sell Wendouree or sell Dom Perignon or what Cristal, is thinking about what media would I need to use that would help me as efficiently as possible reach as many potential category buyers as possible. And if you have very restricted availability of that product, then a lot of the times, like people like Wendouree and things like that, they're trying to sell as much as they can directly because as much of that margin then stays with the brand. So I think whatever business you're in, you know, if the smaller you are, the limited production you have, particularly in the wine sector, as much of the selling that you can control, that's where you can be profitable. But it wouldn't just be kind of direct marketing to the same people over and over and over again because those people already know about you. Yes, you want to remind them that you exist, but ultimately you want to bring more people into the category. And not to sound dark, but even if you think about a mailing list for an ultra premium wine brand, over time, the people that buy those wines are typically very wealthy and older. They're going to pass away. They're going to drink less for health reasons. So you actually do need to be able to recruit new people into the category. So
actually, this is a really good point. I'm thinking of a real world example. So going back to Napa, Napa has for decades built its reputation on these very cult premium wines, which you could only get by sitting on a waiting list for a long time. And I'm not talking about Screaming Eagle or Harlan, he'll always be okay. But there's a group of wines under that. And what they're now finding is that as the baby boomers, as the doctors tell them to stop drinking or they, you know, whatever, that the next group of consumers under them do not want to sit on waiting lists. They don't want to buy a dozen at a time. They don't want, you know, they don't act in that way. So how do you behave when your consumer behavior suddenly flips like that? So how do you keep your original, your baby boomers who are still hanging on happy while having to adjust to a completely new different market?
So I think there's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And I think to use your example from Napa, a lot of those brands do a really good job with a older, more affluent population of meeting the needs of their buyers, which is fantastic. So it demonstrates that they have an aptitude to listen to their consumers, which should give them confidence. But when we talk about mental and physical availability, it doesn't have to be one size fits all for everybody. So if a younger population are communicating and consuming different media channels than an older population, it means that you need to interact with them in a different way that you would an older population. The messaging and the reasons why people might be interested in buying or collecting these things could be different for a affluent 25-year-old or 30-year-old versus an affluent 65-year-old or 70-year-old that's at a different stage of their life. And the way that they buy things might be different. So one of the big aspects of physical availability is making it easy for people to buy you. So we want to kind of remove barriers to purchase. So where maybe some people like being on a list and they like having an allocation, maybe other buyers find that restrictive. So you have the ability with, particularly with digital media and things like that, and digital sales channels, you can have different approaches for different people.
Yeah. Okay. So, of course, the big problem is most wineries do not have waiting lists full of people desperate to buy their cult wines. Most people are facing the fact that growth comes from light and occasional buyers. So given that it is really hard to build a constant audience, what's the most efficient way for a drinks or a wine brand to reach them in practice? And what channels or what methods or what should you prioritize?
So I guess, first of all, just as this, I think the way you phrased that question was brilliant. I think I just want to kind of emphasize that you're right, that the light and occasional buyers are critical. I just don't think that most brands know that. So step one is educating people of the importance of those light and occasional brands and not having that fixation on their heavy buyers or their loyal buyers. So I think education on kind of the principles of the Institute and the laws of growth are critically important to helping people understand that. Then the next question is, how do you do it? Well, first of all, from an efficiency perspective, you want to think about how you can get as much reach as possible, as efficiently as possible and cost effectively as possible. And we're talking about reach in terms of like the media channels that you're looking to reach out to people and interact with them and build those memory structures. But we're also talking about reach in terms of where the buying is happening. And there needs to be an overlap in both of them. So there's no point, you know, having lots of people know about your brand, your Napa brand in Chicago, but you can't buy it anywhere. Mm. So you need to be thinking about where is my wine going to be sold? Where is it going to be listed? And then what am I doing to try and build associations or these memory structures between my brand and those key buying occasions. And particularly in the context of the wine sector, maybe there's scope for regions to work together because you have Napa maybe competing with Sonoma or with Willamette Valley or with Bordeaux or Burgundy. So I think that there's a lot of work of kind of aligning things together. And I think that what we see is these wine brands, their regions, they do a pretty good job in international markets banding together to do promotion and events and things like that. But maybe we see a bit less of that in kind of the domestic market. And that may be an opportunity where people are struggling with budget to do that. And particularly, you know, you have the United States where it's not just the wine sector, you're competing with other alcohol subcategories, you're competing with cannabis, not just for people's budgets and time, but even for natural resources to produce things, right? So it's a big challenge to appeal to as many potential buyers as you can.
What this thing about you know, high involvement, low involvement is really interesting, because when I talk to many wine producers, they, especially around the behavior of young people, they go to wine fairs and they see lots and lots and lots of young people, and they go, I don't understand why people are saying that younger people are drinking less, because around me all I see is these passionate people who are really geeky. How do you get people out of thinking of, you know, that what they see in front of them represents the market? You know, how do you break that way of thinking? Because I hear that all the time.
So I think, first of all, like, you have to understand that people that are coming to wine fairs are typically in the industry. They're either getting paid or they make their living off of the wine industry. So their passion and interest and them thinking about this 40 hours a week or more is not representative of the broader population. I think that we need to realize, and first of all, we're never advocating that those buyers aren't important. All buyers are important. But what we know from the research that we've done is that users of products, users of brands, are much more likely to notice advertising of those brands than non-users. So what that means is that if you're making messaging and communications that is going to appeal to the many more light buyers, your heavy buyers and those people that are high involved are still likely to notice that advertising. Where if you're making messaging and advertising for those heavy buyers, it probably is not going to be something that the light or occasional buyers will comprehend, and they won't notice it. And what we know, because of the law of double jeopardy, growth comes from penetration. You can't shift frequency that much. So trying to get the very, very small population of super fans to buy more, maybe you nudge them up from buying twice a year to three times a year. But there are so many more potential alcohol category buyers or wine buyers that getting them to go from zero to one in a year, or even zero to one in 5 years, is going to deliver incrementally so much more growth for a brand and the sector.
So where do you see brands wasting money by trying to chase loyalty? If you had to stop wineries and or distilleries from doing one thing, what would it be?
A fixation on heavy buyers, a fixation on super fans, a fixation on posting things on their social media channels organically that only reach their, you know, their friends and family and people that are already buyers. Really thinking about, you know, using media channels, but putting investments into that that will lead to reaching new people and reminding and refreshing those memory structures that do exist amongst the buyer base.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the ways that people often, you know, get people to try their product is through sampling programs, whether it's through cellar door or whatever. But this, maybe this builds memory for the occasion, not for the wine. How do you design a tasting program so that people remember the product rather than the occasion? Assuming they will, of course, remember the occasion, but how do you fix the product in their mind?
So first of all, you want to have really good branding and distinctive assets. So I assume you're talking at like a cellar door rather than, like in a restaurant or a bar. But at the cellar door, you need to have excellent branding. So everything from not just on the bottles, but the wine glasses, the napkins, the signs, how your staff are dressed. If you've got other things that are particular distinctive assets, can you have larger versions of them around the cellar door so that you can start to build in people's minds the association that when you see this symbol, it means my brand, or when you see this color, it means my brand. That gives them a chance that when they're in a retailer or they're shopping online, that they have a greater chance of recognizing that. Then, as part of the experience, you wanna create a really good experience that creates an emotional response. So it's really good that you have good people running that tasting program that are interacting. If people have an emotional response to the experience, it will direct attention and it improves memory. And then part of the discussion about the wine is maybe training your staff that for the people that are really into wine and the super fans, sure, you can talk about the tannins and the oak and all of the factors that make the taste the way it is, but also spend a lot of time making sure if you've got regular people that are coming, helping them understand that this wine is great for a barbecue, or it's great for gift giving, or it's great when you want to have a special occasion or you want to relax. And it's really just having that continuity of whatever you're trying to build, those 4 to 6 key occasions or reasons why somebody entered the category, that consistently in every kind of touch point you have with a potential buyer, you're working to kind of build those connections between your brand or that even particular wine and those key buying or usage occasions.
Yeah. What are some of the other laws that we haven't touched on?
The other laws we haven't touched upon: duplication of purchase.
Oh, let's talk about that.
Or the law of brand user profile. So duplication of purchase is a really important tool in the sense that it helps dispel myths regarding loyalty, and it shows that people buy from a repertoire. So duplication of purchase would help you understand not only do people switch between, Screaming Eagle and other Harlan Estates or other famous, Napa brands, but that they buy between Napa and Sonoma and Willamette Valley, or that they are buying Cabernet or Merlot or Chardonnay or Pinot Noir. So that helps you kind of understand what your competitive set is. And then that helps you in a number of ways. One, it helps you dispel the myth that people are only buying you. Secondly, it helps you understand within your own portfolio where you might be cannibalizing yourself or where there might be opportunities for you to grow. So the last thing that you want to be doing is launching new SKUs of wine that are basically going to be just getting people who are going to buy your Cabernet Merlot blend to now buy another one instead. So you want to be thinking about your portfolio development, about how you can bring more buyers in, so get incremental growth, whether that's new buyers or occasions.
How do you know the difference between extending your range and cannibalizing yourself?
Well, all of this would be data-based. And what you would see is whether there is over or under sharing or excess sharing. So if you are looking at things that have more than expected sharing between them, then that would give you then what you would expect in that kind of context. If the evidence shows that, then that would likely show that there's more intense competition.
Can you give me a concrete example of what you're talking about?
Sure. So in the wine sector, you would imagine that you might see from kind of like a more premium perspective, from a flavor profile, you might see similar wine styles sharing more with each other. So whether it's people making a more tannic wine or a more fruity wine, you could kind of see more or less sharing. So if you think about like soft drinks, right, you might see in the carbonated drinks category, you might see groupings of more fruit flavored sodas than just the straight colas. You might see a functional difference in the sense you might see a grouping of the diet or zero calorie ones. You might see a grouping of caffeine free. So those are the things that you want to look for. But the key thing is to never assume anything. Everything needs to be evidence-based. So the idea would be, what data do you have access to or you can get access to that can help you understand that? And I think that fundamentally, if I think back to the start of my career, when I started working with panel data and wine, the person who worked before me did amazing research, but they looked at white wine as a category and they looked at red wine as a category. When I started working with that same data set, we stopped thinking that there were separate categories, and we looked at the category as a whole, and we found that the biggest competition was between the two largest grape varieties, one being a white wine and the other being a red wine, right? So I think that is helping people understand what those competitors are, and then really thinking about not just from the wine styles, but from the occasions where there is overlap. So it may be that brands where you spoke about before, some have more premium SKUs and also more entry-level SKUs. For those entry-level SKUs, you might want to build the memory structures for the more common occasions that are more casual. And for the more premium SKUs, you might be linking to those occasions or reasons why people enter the category that are more relevant for those more premium SKUs.
Now, I just want to change the subject entirely. I was reading a plea on LinkedIn this morning just before I started talking to you from an Australian producer who's talking about the proliferation of private label in Australia and how the major retailers now are awash with what this writer called phantom brands, but I think the rest of us would call private label. Private label is now gearing up in the US as well. So if you're a mid-tier or a small wine brand, what must you do to keep your visibility next to a proliferation of private label?
Sure. So first of all, you need to know what your distinctive assets are or could be, and you need to invest in them and you need to protect them. So if you're constantly changing your branding and the look of your brand, then there's really nothing that you can do to protect another brand from, say, copying the style of your label or your look and feel to try and do that in a private label. The second thing is bearing in mind that those private labels often are owned by the retailers, and they're going to have better shelf placement and better distribution than even you can. So you have to do an even better job of building those memory structures and building those associations between your brand and those key buying occasions, because those private labels are primarily going to be competing on price. Mm-hmm. Now, some are actually quite good in quality. So like, for example, you have Costco and you have Kirkland, which is quite a good brand. And, you know, in South Australia, it's a bit interesting. You can't buy alcohol in supermarkets, so people here can't experience the Kirkland Select stuff. But if you go interstate, or I've been to the U.S., you know, Kirkland Champagne's not Cristal, but it's still pretty good, right? And it's the same thing in supermarkets, right? We're seeing this evolution of private labels that are getting better. And I guess we just need to make sure as brands that you can't change things. All you can do is focus on making sure that your marketing is as good as it can possibly be, and your branding is consistent, and you're protecting your brand and not allowing yourself to dilute it through your own even best intentions, but that can become damaging.
Yeah. Another quick question. Many, many wine producers particularly, but also in other categories like spirits as well, believe that if they make the product the best, that that will give them the market advantage. And yet through this podcast, I've interviewed many people who come from different drinks spaces, and they tell me that's not true. What's your take on this?
That's a good question. I think what I'll do is, since we've been talking a lot about mental availability, I'll link it back to that from my perspective. So first of all, when you look at kind of attitudinal measures for, which is different to mental availability, but you look at attitudinal measures and you measure rejection, rejection rates for brands are typically quite low. And usually you just want to make sure that you're in the vicinity of the rejection rate for the category. So
hang on, you're going to have to explain what you mean by that. I'm not quite sure.
So when you look at people and they go, this is a brand that I really like or love, this is something that I'm okay about, this is something that I'm not a fan of, or this is something that I hate and I would never buy, I'm making it much more casual, but there are specific questions that you can ask when you're measuring the attitude. But one option would be, this is a brand I would reject, I would never buy, right? Most people are fixated on, what are the reasons why people won't buy me? What are my problems with rejection? And they're fixated on, oh, it's because we have to taste better or do this or do that. However, the vast majority of times you don't get bought isn't because people don't like you, it's because they don't think about you. So the bigger brands get bought because they're thought of in more purchase occasions. Okay. So if you're a wine brand, over time, what you want to do is not just be known as a wine that's great for collecting or great for aging, but also go, actually, I want to be known for gift giving or special occasion or romance or a business dinner. And actually, the bigger brands that get bought more are actually when people have all of these different buying needs, your brand enters into that consideration set from it. And what we use is, we use the analogy of kind of like, you know, to win a gold medal at the Olympics, you've got to qualify for that gold medal race. So you've got to be in as many races as possible. And where people are often fixated on, you know, how I get on the podium, right? How do I get that gold medal? They're actually not thinking much about, how do I qualify for the Olympics? How do I qualify for that race? And that's probably where the biggest risk and also the biggest opportunity is whether there's 100 brands or 1,000 brands, how do you go from there being 1,000 bottles of wine in a wine retailer to being the 4 that are being considered by somebody? Where if all you're thinking about is, how do I go from 4 to 1 or from 2 to 1, you're missing that opportunity to get so many more people to think about you. And of course, they're not going to buy you all the time, but getting into that more races to win, you'll have that probability that will ultimately work in your favor.
Okay, finally, as we've talked about throughout this morning, the wine trade and also spirits and to a lesser extent beer is in acute distress right now. If you could get people to change one thing about their approach, what would it be?
Stop focusing on loyalty, stop focusing on heavy buyers, and think about how their brand operates, not just within the category that it sits in, but more broadly in the alcohol category, and what are the opportunities to kind of, reach different people than what they currently are reaching.
Justin, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Do.